"The Earl of Corris, Your Holiness," the upper priest said, as he bowed Philip Osgood into the small private meeting chamber. It wasn't very much of a bow, Corris reflected. Then again, the upper priest was assigned to the Chancellor's office. He probably saw dukes by the dozen and earls by the score, and God only knew how many bevies of mere barons he might encounter every year. Not to mention the fact that most of the dukes and earls who crossed his path weren't dispossessed exiles living on someone else's charity.
"So I see," a voice replied. "Come in, my lord."
Corris obeyed the summons and found himself facing a tallish, lean man with an angular face, a closely trimmed beard, and deep, intelligent eyes. He wore the orange cassock of a vicar, and he matched the description of Vicar Zompson Trenaire quite well. Trenaire extended his hand, and Corris bent to kiss the sapphire ring, then straightened.
"Your Holiness," he acknowledged.
"We appreciate the promptness with which you've responded to our summons, my lord, especially at this time of the year," Trenaire said.
His smile never touched his eyes.
"Would that all of Mother Church's sons were so mindful of their duty to her."
"I won't pretend it wasn't an arduous journey, Your Holiness,"
Corris allowed himself a slight wry smile of his own.
"But as a boy, I was always taught that when Mother Church calls, her sons answer. And it was also interesting, especially the voyage across Lake Pei, while the opportunity to finally visit the temple is an added blessing."
"Good!"
The single perfunctory word came not from silver-haired, heavy-jowled vicar who hadn't bothered to rise when Corris entered. There was no doubt about his identity either, the Earl thought, although he was just a bit surprised to realize Jaspar Clinton matched so completely the descriptions he'd received. Right down to the spots spilled food had left on his cassock.
"There ought to be a rule that real villains aren't allowed to look like stereotypical villains," Corris thought, and felt a tiny shiver run through him as he realized how he'd just allowed himself to describe Clinton.
It wasn't really a surprise. He'd been headed in that direction for years, after all. Yet there was an odd sense of commitment to the moment, as if he'd crossed some irrevocable bridge, even if he was the only one who realized he had.
"And you'd damned well better make sure you stay the old expression." He didn't much care, told himself.
From Clinton's expression, he didn't much care what might be going through Corris's mind at the moment. Nor did he appear to feel tempted to expend any courtesy on their visitor. Where Trenaire's eyes held the cool dispassion of a chess master, Clinton's glowed with the fervor of a zealot. A fervor which confirmed Corris's long-standing opinion that Clinton was, by far, the more dangerous of the two.
"Please be seated, my lord," Trenaire invited,
indicating the single chair on Corris's side of the meeting room table. It was the simplest chair Corris had yet seen inside the temple, a straight-backed, apparently unpadded, utilitarian piece of furniture. It was certainly a far cry from the throne-like chairs in which Trenaire and Clinton were ensconced. Yet when he settled onto it, he almost jumped back to his feet in astonishment, as what had appeared to be a simple wooden surface seemed to shift under him. It moved, flowed, and he couldn't keep his eyes from widening as the chair shaped itself perfectly to the configuration of his body. He looked up to see Trenaire regarding him speculatively and made himself smile at the Chancellor. It was an expression which blended an admission of surprise with a sizable dollop of boyish enjoyment, and Trenaire allowed himself the small chuckle of a host who has successfully surprised a guest. Clinton, predictably probably, seemed completely oblivious to the small moment, Corris noted.
"Best not to assume anything of the sort, Philip," he told himself. "I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Clinton's long since figured out just how useful it can be to have potential opponents underestimate one's powers of observation. The only thing in the world more dangerous than a fool, especially when it comes to the great game, is a smart man you've assumed is stupid. Narmin should certainly have taught you that much.
Well, Trinair began briskly after a moment, now that you're here, my lord, I suppose we ought to get right down to business. As you know, I have, as Mother Church's Chancellor, and acting on Grand Vicar Eric's specific instructions, formally recognized young Prince Divan as the rightful ruler of Coruscant. Given his tender years, it struck us as unnecessary to bring him all the way to the temple to discuss his future with him. You, on the other hand, are his legal guardian. Since we do not, and never will, recognize that travesty of a regency council Caleb and Charlian have foisted upon God, we also regard you as the closest thing Divan has at this time to a true regent.
He paused, as if inviting comment, but Corus wasn't about to rush into that particular snare. He contented himself with a slow nod of understanding and an attentive expression instead.
In light of the circumstances, the Chancellor resumed a few seconds later, we think it's essential to regularize Divan's position. While he would appear to be safe enough for the moment under the protection of King James, especially given the fact Delphirac is already at war with the apostates, there are certain aspects of his situation which we feel require formal clarification.
He paused once more, and this time it was obvious he intended to stay paused until Corus responded.
"Formal clarification, Your Holiness," the Earl obediently repeated. "May I ask what sort of clarification?"
"Oh, come now, my lord!"
Clinton entered the discussion, waving one hand in a dismissive gesture.
"You are Prince Hector's spymaster. You know how the game is played, if anyone does.